You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, April 13th, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps and steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, journalist Catherine Stewart on the power worshipers inside the dangerous rise of religious nationalism. Meanwhile, Donald Trump mad at Dr. Fauci. He's also looking to complete a conservative dream of destroying the post office. Meanwhile, confusion and failure mark the Paycheck Protection Act. And those emergency funds keep waiting. Schumer and Pelosi seem absolutely determined to put the Dems' weakest foot forward in the phase four bailout, despite the fact that how suddenly offended they were by the Wisconsin voting situation. Meanwhile, food shortages and waste, the story of a messed up supply lines and failed workplace safety laws. In New York, de Blasio cancels schools, and then 15 minutes later, Cuomo tries to reverse. In Virginia, Northam makes Virginia, or I should say institutes, the most democratic voting reforms arguably in the nation. Lastly, chloroquine study in Brazil halted over fatal heart complications. All this and more on today's program. Nice 5 second fade there, Brendan. I appreciate that. We're all here. Every day is a new set of technical challenges. You might be able to hear Matt slamming away at his keyboard, trying to figure out how he can get sound out of his computer. Hopefully you're hearing the sound of my voice. Brendan and Matt are here. We will get to all this. I hope everyone made it through the weekend. There seems to be some leveling off, you know, broadly speaking in the country, but places like Michigan are starting to hit new highs as the I wouldn't say the epicenter yet of the outbreaks have moved at this point. Still, I think New York remains the most problematic place in the world. At this moment, anyways, Sweden, which had been pursuing a fairly lax perspective on this, is now shooting up, having problems on a per capita basis. We'll keep our eyes open for that. There's been some reports of a resurgence, small one, in China since things loosened up. We will keep our eyes on that for you. And then, you know, endeavor to continue on with our various types of programming that we've been having on this program since day one in many respects. We will do the plugs and updates at the end of the show. Just a little bit of house cleaning. The godfather of this program, Kyle from fansfm.fm, has now updated the apps again. Not only is there a huge amount of functionality that's there, not only has he instituted a system so that if you're having problems with your membership paying for it, you go, you cancel, we give you automatically some other options. there are now push notifications on the app. We're not going to blast these notifications right now. Maybe once a day, we'll let you know what's going to be on the show. If something, if I hop on YouTube, we'll send out a blast. Of course, via the app, you can watch the show on YouTube live. You can stream the audio live. You can IM the show. And I think he's working on a special members-only hotline through the app. But you don't need to be a member to get the app. You can go to majorityapp.com. It's free for everybody. It gives you all those things. And the AM Quickie is on there. And you can also become a member of the show. And it has a searchable database of all the shows. All, what are we at now? 3,000 shows, close to it. And you can find those and you can become a member of the program at jointhemajorityreport.com. Not going to lie, our ad revenues, and this is across the board, I imagine this is the case for every show, have gone down pretty dramatically over the past month. And of course, we have members who have lost their jobs, who anticipate losing their jobs, et cetera, or have some have gotten ill and so have been unable to maintain their memberships. We will not lock anybody out for money. That's always been the policy here since day one of this program. So if you want the show, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com and just let us know and give us a little time. We will hook you up if you cannot afford it. If you can afford it and you've been meaning to become a member, now's a good time. Join the majorityreport.com. Donald Trump, and there's more and more reporting to this effect. He's really just looking at his ratings for his, you know, little show he does every day, which is, you know, not unlike the other shows that are on television that are also fictional, largely fictional. And apparently he's getting a little mad because his co-star, Dr. Fauci, is getting better reviews than he is. And so the reporting was that over the weekend, he spent a lot of time asking people around him, like, what do you think about Fauci? Like, almost like looking for someone to give him the idea you should fire this guy, which is a terrifying thought at this point. Here is Donald Trump saying he wants to reopen the economy. What is this based upon? Obviously, there's a need to get things going, but it seems every single expert that I have read, the first thing they say is we need testing capacity. For some reason, there are other countries in the world that have been able to roll this out. We seem totally incapable of it. And now there's reports of the swabs that they use are starting to suffer shortages. We need to have testing before we get back to any semblance. It's not going to be normal, any semblance of normalcy. But Donald Trump has another plan. It's sort of like that secret plan to win Vietnam. Here is a clip of Donald Trump on Friday at his White House presser, I guess.
Obviously, a lot of interest in how you're going to make that decision.
That's a very big decision. I don't know that I've had a bigger decision than that when you think, right?
I mean, think
of that decision. Somebody said it's totally up to the president. I saw this morning. It's totally up, and it is. I don't know that I've had a bigger decision, but I'm going to surround myself with the greatest minds. Not only the greatest minds, but the greatest minds in numerous different businesses, including the business of politics and reason. And we're going to make a decision.
Pause it for one second. They're asking, like, how are you going to go about make this decision to open up the country? Now, look, the reality is Donald Trump can get up there and say the country is now open for business. But he doesn't really have any authority other than guidance to offer. The states have been issuing these pause orders, and they're the only ones that can basically roll them back. But he's been talking to leaders of the business of politics and reason. And what will he garner from all these people? Well, we're going to find out.
Numerous different businesses, including the business of politics and reason. And we're going to make a decision, and hopefully it's going to be the right decision. I will say this. I want to get it open as soon as we can. We have to get our country open, Jeff.
Can you say, sir, what metrics you will use to make that decision?
The metrics right here. That's my metrics. That's all I can do. I can listen to 35 people. At the end, I've got to make a decision. And I didn't think of it until yesterday. I said, you know, this is a big decision. But I want to be guided. I'm going to be guided by them. I'm going to be guided by our vice president. I'm going to make a decision based on a lot of different opinions. Some will maybe disagree, and some I'd love to see it where they don't disagree. Will there be risks? There's always going to be a risk that something can flare up. There's always going to look at what's happening where countries are trying to get open and there's a flare up and they'll go. But I'd like the flare-up to be very localized so that we can control it from a local standpoint without having to close.
You know, before we get to the substance of what he's talking about, which is that he doesn't know what the word metrics means and doesn't seem to have any type of benchmarks that he's willing to share with us, which I imagine is just simply polling. Can you imagine if we were in the throes of a pandemic and what will be a huge economic disaster for the country if Barack Obama came out wearing a pink tie? I may be a little bit sensitive to it only because back in the day, Rush Limbaugh would complain about the wussification of America as in, you know, as indicated by Dick Durbin's pink tie. And we had a caller who called in about Dick Durbin's pink tie. And this was the type of issues at the time that would dominate the press for like a day or two. Barack Obama's tan suit. And this guy is wearing festive ties in the midst of his TV show. I don't really care, but it just, I don't know why I couldn't help but notice that. But the idea that the metrics are all in his head, he's not going to share them with us, or they don't exist. And he only thought about it yesterday, that this is a big decision. This is his way of saying it's my decision to make. I mean, this is all totally marketing for him. This is all about creating an image where he's got the whole world on his shoulders and I can handle it. And they've coached him well to say now, like, you know, take the advice of these other people. But that I'm not convinced that he's not trying to intimidate those other people. It's time for you to get on board with my idea of when we should open. What are the metrics? Whatever I wake up in the morning and think like, what's happening in terms of my reelection? I mean, at one point, he is going to make the determination that it's all or nothing. It's Trump or bust. And he's going to say, like, if I can't get the economy going now, then I'm going to lose. And if that's the case, I'd rather lose trying than not. And the trying is going to be, in other words, with the risk of 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90, 100,000 deaths, maybe more. I don't know. So Donald Trump, ladies and gentlemen, your president. Here's a message from our sponsor, ZipRecruiter. They say, right now, we cannot be overwhelmed. We have to work to keep our loved ones safe and protect our communities. We have to work to stay strong, to stay connected, to stay focused. We have to work to inspire, to innovate, to build new solutions. But for all of this to work, we have to work together. ZipRecruiter connects employers and people every day, but today is different. ZipRecruiter is partnering with first responders, government officials, the medical community, the innovators in the manufacturing, transportation, and food distribution industries to make sure they're finding the right people for the right jobs right now. Let's work together. ZipRecruiter.com/work together. All right, folks. Going to take a quick break. When we come back, we will be talking to Catherine Stewart about the power worshipers inside the dangerous rise of religious nationalism. And this is coming after an Easter weekend where the DOJ basically threatened mayors and other state and local officials to not interfere with Easter services. Because it might increase the infection rate within these towns and counties. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Sam Seder, Majority Report. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Catherine Stewart. She is the author of The Power Worshippers, Inside the Dangerous Rise of Religious Nationalism. She is a reporter, also writing opinion pieces for the New York Times. Catherine, welcome to the program.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Catherine, I want to just start with getting a sense of or letting folks know what was involved in reporting this? This has been a long time project for you.
That's true. I mean, the book was really the consequence of 10 years of research into this area. It's kind of a deep dive into the leading personalities and policy organizations of this movement that's turned religion into a tool for political power.
You, in much of the book is written, well, I shouldn't say, there's a lot of first person, I think, experiences as you go around the country and visit these people. But let's just start, too, with why you refer to these folks as Christian nationalists as opposed to the Christian right or religious conservatives, et cetera.
Right. I mean, the first thing to know about Christian nationalism or religious nationalism is it's not a religion. It's a political ideology. Its representatives insist that the foundation of government is bound up with the reactionary understanding of religion. I use the term nationalism because it bears similarities with other forms of religious nationalism around the world. And I call it Christian nationalism, obviously, in deference to their own understanding of the religion that they're promoting, which is which they say is a Christian. But I also use terms like Christian right and religious right where appropriate. I often prefer religious nationalism in referring to the whole, specifically because it does bear similarities to other forms of religious nationalism. So if you look around the world, like in Turkey or Russia or Erdogan, in Orban in Hungary, when they bind themselves tightly, these leaders that bind themselves tightly to religious conservatives in their countries in order to consolidate an authoritarian form of power, we rightly recognize that as a form of religious nationalism. And that's what we're seeing today with Trump's alliances with our own hyper-conservative religious leaders.
I'm trying to figure out if I should add. Let's start with abortion, because for many years, I mean, I've been talking about some variant of these folks, right? And they were particularly more public, it feels like, during the Bush administration than they are now. But my sense is that they're more powerful now than they were then. And so I had been aware of the genesis of abortion as a political, as a real political issue, but I had not seen the quotes from Billy Graham or known the stuff about the Baptist press. Go through that, because, and also tell the story about Bob Jones University. Because I'm very curious. I mean, after we discuss that, I want to get, you know, I want people just to have this in the back of their mind, this question of, you know, which comes first for these specific set of people, the drive for power or the drive of religion, I guess. But let's first start with abortion.
Right. Well, religious right has sold us this idea that their movement was a grassroots reaction to abortion, as you've said. But one of the key issues that actually animated the movement in its earlier days was the fear that racially segregated academies might be deprived of their lucrative tax exemptions. So Jerry Falwell and many of his other Southern white conservative leaders were very closely involved with segregated Christian schools and universities. Jones Sr., who one of them, went so far as to call segregation God's established order. He actually referred to desegregationists as satanic propagandists who were leading colored Christians astray. He delivered a sermon called "Is Segregation Scriptural?" It's incredible. You can look it up. It's actually footnoted in my book. I mean, as far as he and these other pastors were concerned, they had a right not just to separate people on the basis of color, but also to receive federal money for the purpose. So they coalesced around this fear that the Supreme Court might end these tax exemptions for segregated Christian schools. But they, you know, they were trying to unite a new movement. These were leaders of a sort of intellectual movement called the New Right. And they really wanted to bring together conservative Catholics, conservative evangelical Protestants, and also some other groups. And they knew that sort of stop the tax on segregation wasn't really going to be an effective rallying cry and unite a hyper-conservative revolution. So there's this fascinating episode where they got together and basically went down a laundry list of issues they thought might unite their new movement. And this was in 1979, 6 years after Roe v. Wade had been passed. So again, you know, they worried about the tax privileges of racist academies, but that wasn't going to work. They were also really worried about women's rights and the women's movement. But they sort of realized, they settled eventually on this idea that they could unite around the issue of abortion, and basically said, well, that could work. So, I mean, let's look at the sort of overtime piece of this. When Roe versus Wade was passed, most Protestant Republicans supported it. They supported some form of abortion law, liberalization. So, you know, in the Baptist press, they published an editorial hailing the decision. This was a press that was run by the Southern Baptist Convention. Ronald Reagan passed the most liberal abortion law in 1967. Conservative hero Barry Goldwater supported abortion law liberalization, at least early in his career. And my favorite fun fact is that his wife, Peggy, was a co-founder of Planned Parenthood in Arizona. Can you imagine that happening with any conservative leader today? But over time, these pro-choice voices were purged from the Republican Party. So we're seeing today kind of pro-life religion. It's a modern creation. It was created for political purposes. The reason it was created, because Republican and leaders and Christian nationalist leaders know that if you can get people to vote on a single issue or one or two issues, you can capture their vote. And that's why they've invested an enormous amount of energy in messaging and media, in trying to promote the idea of, you know, abortion restriction and abortion elimination as the single most important issue of their time. When people are voting for against abortion, you know, when they're voting for those hyper-conservative candidates that promise to end abortion, they're also voting for a whole panoply of right-wing and libertarian economic policies, and get people to sort of ignore all that, and get them to vote on this one issue.
So, I mean, let's just assume, and I think it's a fairly safe assumption, some level of sincerity amongst those who vote based upon abortion. I'm curious as to your sense of the sincerity of these power brokers as to the issue.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, when the leaders of the movement are talking to the rank and file, or when they're talking to pastors about the issues, they should communicate to their rank and file in order to turn out the vote. It's all abortion all the time. Abortion is the beginning and the end. But when the leaders are speaking to their political allies, and also especially to their plutocratic funders, they're advocating a very wide range of policy positions. And a lot of it has to do with money, and they justify it through religious rhetoric. So it's all about how the Bible supports low taxes for the rich or no taxes, how the Bible supports minimum regulation of business or no regulation, how the Bible is against environmental regulations. So this drives home the fact that this is a political movement, a broad political movement, and not just a stance in the so-called culture wars. And, you know, we were talking about what the rank of, you know, feel, and many people sincerely want to end abortion. And listen, I think it can take any number of nuanced positions on this issue and not yourself or not think of yourself as a Christian nationalist. But if you are allowing this one single issue to determine your vote, you are lending support for an agenda of religious nationalism, and you are supporting politicians that are going to support policies that are going to end up having less support for the poor, fewer environmental regulations, promoting policies like, you know, lack of access to birth control, things like that, which are going to end up in an increasing number. You know, this is just going to complicate the issue.
What is your sense about what is driving these folks in terms of the political movement? I mean, is it power? And I'm talking about the leadership here. Is it simply power to, you know, which ultimately, you know, I think centers around money and the institutional power that these organizations have, which is also a function, again, of how much money they're able to generate and how much influence they have within the power. Is it power that's driving it, or is it a quest for power driven by religion? Is it even really relevant to ask the question?
No, it's absolutely a legitimate question. It's all of the above. It's power for themselves, their political allies. It's a far-right kind of economic policies that's going to help enrich many of their plutocratic funders and reorganize society. And certainly it's about justices in the Supreme Court and federal. Last time I checked, Trump had appointed 192 federal judges. That's over 22% of the federal judiciary. So the courts are stamped with the consequences of that 2016 election. You know, Christian nationalists understand the importance of capturing the courts, and that's how many of them have justified their support for a leader like Trump. But there's more than that. I think that, you know, the movement is profoundly anti-democratic. They don't seem to have much respect in representative government or even the two-party system. And they seem to long for a more authoritarian form of power. And that's another reason why they support a leader like Trump. You know, it's a very tribal movement. It's very hyper-partisan. You're sort of like in or you're out. You're sort of a member of the pure or the impure. And this is a movement that put Trump in office. He's delivering to them everything that they asked for.
You know, I interviewed a biographer of Mike Pence who described Pence as the most powerful theocrat. I'm not sure exactly if you use Christian nationalist or theocrat. I can't quite remember, but the most powerful theocrat we've ever had in office. You write about Ralph Dollinger. Tell us a little bit about Pence's relationship to these folks, and maybe let's go through a couple of these names like Jeffries and Dollinger, and the idea that Ralph Reed is still kicking around. Again, I think he is the perfect example, it seems to me, of how, and you tell me if this is correct, and maybe it's just my own sort of a shift in perspective, but it does feel like they are a little bit more subterranean, or maybe that's just a function of the press, because, you know, it seems so inconsistent to talk about these type of folks with Donald Trump as the president, as opposed to George Bush, who was sort of self-professed. I mean, maybe Donald Trump is self-professed, but I mean, who believes him on this? Are they just less public facing in some ways?
You know, I think that in a way, getting in plain sight, I mean, conspiracies happen under the darkness with unnamed actors. This is largely happening out in the open. It's not really that they're hiding. It's that most people aren't paying attention. So you talked about Ralph Dollinger, who is the founder of a group called Capital Ministries that targets political leaders at the highest echelons of power. I mean, Dollinger makes his Bible studies that he teaches to these political leaders public. You can look them up on his website. And if you look on his website, he's got a list of called capital sponsors. And Pence is on that list as a number of a dozen current and former members of Trump's cabinet. They're listed as cabinet sponsors on Dollinger's website, which anyone can see. They've attended his weekly Bible study in the nation's capital. Dollinger also has Bible study groups targeting the House of Representatives and the Senate and various state houses. And he is conducting a form of shadow diplomacy with political leaders around the world. So I would say that he's one of the most politically influential pastors in America. And again, his expansive positions on domestic, economic, and foreign policy hits home the fact that Christian nationalism is a political movement, not merely a stance in the so-called culture war, not a religion. But of course, he uses the rhetoric of religion to justify his positions. He promotes the idea that social welfare programs have no basis in scripture. He's against progressive income taxes, and he has a theology of taxation that unabashedly favors the rich. So, you know, again, this is all music to the ears of the movement's plutocratic funders. And you mentioned a number of other really intriguing characters. Ralph Reed is one. A lot of the research I did involved going to Road to Majority conferences, and which is, I mean, Ralph Reed is sort of the head of that, and Values Voter Summit and Marches for Life and other types of events. And Ralph Reed is a very savvy political leader. I remember in advance of the 2016 elections, he talked about the resources his group, which is only one group out of many, was going to bring to bear on the 2016 election. And it was like targeting, you know, huge amounts of money, swing districts, and it was all focused on getting out the vote among sympathetic voters. You know, it wasn't really about winning over voters that were going to sort of, had already declared as Democrats. It was really about, this is where we're going to go. We're going to knock door to door. We're going to text people. We're going to send all these messages to them. And they were going to, you know, if they haven't voted by 4 p.m., we're going to drive to their house and take them to their polling spots. So there's a really well-oiled sort of get-out-vote machine among this movement. The movement isn't, you know, it's got a number of leaders, but the leaders are almost less important than the organizations. The movement consists of this dense ecosystem of for-profit and non-profit groups, right-wing policy groups, legal advocacy organizations, data initiatives, they've really mastered the data piece of this, and media and networking organizations. So, you know, I really tried to lay out as much of this ecosystem as I could in my book. The important thing to understand about it is not its diversity as much as its source of unity, which is a common political vision.
And I want to talk about that because I'm really interested in talking a little bit about the data miners and the attorneys on this. But Ralph Reed is a perfect example, it seems to me, of a guy who used to be on television all the time. I met him once. I was at a CNN, like a house party, like a Christmas event. And I have to say, he was one of the most terrifying people I've ever met. I mean, he was perfectly nice. He was like an animatron. He was very, very strange.
He's very clever, very clever. He had this quote. I'm probably going to flub it a little bit. I'm going to paraphrase. He said something like, "Don't pay attention to the polls. It doesn't matter what percentage of the population we have. That percentage is declining. All that matters is turnout, who turns out to vote on election day." So he knows that. He also spoke about gerrymandering and voter suppression as what he called the Republican reapportionment advantage. Like, just very blithely, you know, he said, "Well, if the split of support is 50-50, Republicans win. You know, if the split is like 6-8, it's, you know, a Democratic favor, jump ball. And if it's 8 and above, Democrats win." So he really, really understands the consequences of voter suppression and gerrymandering, often race-based. And he's pretty matter of fact about that. Look, in a country where 40 to 50% of people don't bother to turn out to vote, or who vote third party, you don't really need a majority of the population to win elections. All you need is like a really dedicated and organized and activated minority. This movement is a minority of the population, but they're winning elections precisely because they're so coherent and networked, and they understand, this is really key, they understand the value of unity when necessary. They're, you know, a lot of them, Trump wasn't their first choices, but I heard at one of Ralph Reed's gatherings, I heard this one leader stand up and say, "This election is about judges, judges, judges." And so people, you know, there are many folks who liked Trump for a variety of, you know, reasons in that movement, and others were not too fond of him, but they held their noses and voted for him because they knew that when they voted him in office, he was going to nominate the judges that were favorable to their interests.
I mean, they're religious zealots. I mean, it's, you know, that's almost like written into the definition, right, of folks like this. I mean, there's a zealotry, and there is a willingness or a predisposition, almost definitionally, I think, to voices of authority. Right? I mean, that's what it is to be.
It is a much more authoritarian emphasis, is like a kind of biblical literalism, the idea that hierarchies are ordained by God should be, you know, and that there are, you know, our laws should be based on the Bible, really. They don't really seem to have much respect for many of our most cherished constitutional principles as they were written. But let's not forget that there's, you know, people often describe the movement as evangelical, and it does include many evangelicals, but it excludes many evangelicals too. And I think most American Christians, and it also includes representatives of a variety of Protestant and non-Protestant religion. I mean, I think most American Christians reject the values of conquest and domination that the movement represents. And they too are very passionate about the Bible. They just have a different reading of it. But Christian nationalists reserve some of the most poisonous words for those who identify as a Christians of a different sort. There is a large movement of evangelicals who are really trying to question whether this movement is authentically Christian in the first place.
I mean, just to get back to, I just want to touch on this, and then I want to move into another area. But I don't mean to focus so much time on Ralph Reed, but he just seems to be an example of what I'm talking about. 10 years ago, 15 years ago, guys like Ralph Reed, guys like Pat Robertson, guys like Jerry Falwell, they were on TV as much as possible, it seems to me. Or at least, you know, mainstream cable television. Do they feel that they don't have to do that anymore? Not those guys, obviously, but Ralph Reed is one of them. Do they feel like they don't need to do that anymore because they have their own networks that are sufficient in reaching their people? I mean, what, like, why don't we, I mean, that's what I mean by flying under the radar. Not that they're being, not that they're hiding. It's just that they're not getting out there in front of the cameras, it seems to me, in a way that they used to.
Oh, they're just getting out in front of different cameras. Okay. I mean, we can't discount the effect of the right-wing propaganda sphere in growing this movement. Tony Perkins is, I think it's daily now. He does something called Washington Watch. It's listened to widely. If you look at Focus on the Family, they do media programming. I think they've got something like 80, like some huge number, like millions and millions, tens of millions of subscribers or places where those that programming is aired. There's just this really comprehensive right-wing media sphere that I spent a lot of time on when I was writing my book. And it's astonishing. You can hear a lot of stuff that will sort of help you understand why someone like Trump won in 2016 and why he really does present a formidable challenge in 2020. I remember one of those, I'm sorry, again, one of Ralph Reed's events, I just want to bring this up, a Road to Majority conference. I heard, I think it was George Barna or somebody, like George Barna is a right-wing evangelical pollster, and he's sort of been in deep with some of these leading organizations. And he said something like, we want to make it so that our people, meaning the sort of folks who follow this movement and turned out their support for these hyper-conservative Republican candidates, he said, we want to make it so that they don't have to watch CNN or MSNBC or any of this other, they call, you know, fake news media, anything fact-checkable, I suppose. And he said, we're working on that. You know, we have our own networks that we're developing. And there are always now new initiatives, new, you know, Facebook sites or various types of platforms. It's not just limited to Fox and Breitbart. And there's just a whole lot of other platforms out there where that type of propaganda gets spread.
I think, you know, that must be a big part of it, because it seems to me that like every other day, you know, even like 10 years ago, I would read something about Answers in Genesis, or I would read about, Perkins and Focus on the Family and, one initiative or another. And they seem to, and maybe it's just, there's less reporters. It's fallen out of fashion in the mainstream, but it's obviously been just as vibrant. I want to touch just a little bit on the Federalist Society and their role in this, because I think many people just perceive the Federalist Society as just being conservative in terms of like the way that they, groom judges, but they are far more tied to the Christian nationalism, I think, than maybe they have been given credit. And, you know, we had one judge who I know is up for a circuit appeals job, who just wrote a ruling just this weekend about dealing with attacking a mayor for discouraging drive-in church services, and may have even like sort of made up like the idea that there was a ban there as a way of sort of signaling to folks in the Federalist Society and folks who are helping with this nomination process that he's a guy you can count on in these situations. But it strikes me as fascinating that, you know, a big part of his resume padding would be along these religious lines, and this whole idea of protecting religious freedom, which is the latest attack on things like the First Amendment, the latest line of attack where Betsy DeVos at the Department of Education is attempting basically to take this public education money and funnel it into parochial schools. Talk about that aspect of it.
Yeah, well, the Federal Society, as you said, and an organization like the Judicial Crisis Network play an outsized role in cultivating and promoting right-wing candidates for judicial appointments. There was a really fantastic piece, and I wrote about this in my book, the amounts of money. There's a piece in the Washington Post that sort of lays it out. I referred to that in my book, and I put in some other materials that I had from my own reporting. The amounts of money that they spend promoting right-wing candidates for judicial appointments, not just for the Supreme Court, but also federal courts, is astonishing. You'd be shocked. I couldn't believe it. You know, some of these Federal Society adjacent organizations are moving like, you know, tens of millions of dollars in order to, many tens of millions of dollars in order to promote judicial appointments. You always think of it, oh, you know, the president sort of floats a couple of names and people like him or they don't, they do their own research. It's not like that. So, you know, I think a lot of the strategy of the movement comes from these very well-funded legal advocacy groups like the Federal Society, Judicial Crisis Network, and then also from the Alliance Defending Freedom, which has been described as a legal juggernaut of the Christian right. The leaders of the ADF, or Alliance Defending Freedom, have asserted that our laws should be based on their interpretations of the Bible, you know, rather than on longstanding democratic and constitutional principles. So you're right. A lot of this stuff is coming from these outside legal groups. And in terms of the whole, you know, idea of promoting this idea of religious freedom, I mean, you know, it's not just for them about, you know, making it possible for these right-wing sort of Christians with a supposedly correct beliefs to be able to discriminate against others of whom they disapprove. So a lot of the bills that come through, the so-called religious freedom bills, are called anti-LGBT bills, and they are that too. And this is not to discount the fact that they are, many of them, very homophobic, although they're now increasingly being used to discriminate against people of other faiths, people in interfaith families, and the non-religious. But I think the calls for the so-called religious freedom in the movement are as loud and passionate as they are because they're also grounded in a fear that people, that the movement doesn't want to lose their lucrative tax exemptions, and also B, because they're trying to access a larger flow of public money. So you mentioned Betsy DeVos. Let's just look at that as an example. Religious groups, including schools, already receive significant tax benefits and subsidies in the form of exemptions, vouchers, grants, etc. So they get a lot of public money and subsidies to begin with. They don't have to open their books to the government and show how they spend it. So, but they really want more. They want even more than they've already got. And the United States spends about $500 billion per year on public K through 12 education. Religiously motivated voucher activists know if they can capture a portion of that money in the name of so-called religious liberty, then the money is going to flow without end. So they've placed a key court case in front of the Supreme Court, involves a school district in Montana. And they're basically trying to get the court to effectively say that denying public money to religious schools is a violation of their religious freedom. And if that's the case, then, you know, the government has no choice but to fund religious organizations. And that seems to be what they're after. So they're doing this in a lot of other areas as well, but it's just very stark in the area of public education. Now, let's not forget that Betsy DeVos, her family has sort of been a longtime, you know, mega funder of the religious right. They spent, you know, millions of dollars on right-wing policy groups and other, you know, leading pastors who've bashed public schools and things like that. So she comes from a kind of history that has always looked askance at best at public education. And when you mentioned, like, you know, under the, you know, that it's not as overt as it used to be, I think in the case of Betsy DeVos, that is a bit true, although if you spend a little bit of time researching her life and groups that she's been involved with, it's quite clear. But she and her husband spoke at a gathering, literally called a gathering, where they talked about their involvement in what they call education reform, which is defunding public schools by funneling money to private religious schools, et cetera. She said, something to the effect of, we need to not speak too openly about this. They call it as a means of advancing God's kingdom. They said it's a way to advance kingdom gain. And when they say kingdom, they're talking about a religious idea of funding, God's kingdom, a sort of Christian nationalist idea of religion. And then her husband later said to this meeting, we need to be careful about talking too much about these activities. So he was signaling to this group that, we're going to be careful in our public facing messaging about this agenda.
I remember reading about, it was an interview that the two of them gave together, talking about the idea that she didn't have an issue with public education, just public schools, because what she wanted to do was to divert public education. To her meant money coming from the public to schools. And I think a lot of her privatization push and charter push is essentially a fig leaf for getting money to parochial schools from, public money, public tax dollars that are ostensibly meant for public education sent to parochial schools. All right. Well, so with all this said, and, there was a quote, something to the effect, and I can't figure out from my notes who said it, was something like, all we need is 10% of the population to make a lot of these changes, which is a derivation of a quote that I've heard from a lot of different people. Maybe it's 5%, 7%, sometimes people say. But you need 10% of highly dedicated people, and you have the ability to run the tables, essentially. So with that in mind, what can we do? During the Obama years, at one point, I think he said in a fundraiser, these folks are clutching their guns and God and or religion, and there's an awareness of it. But what can we do in this instance?
Well, you're right. The religious nationalists are a minority of our population, but they're overrepresented at the ballot box because they're organized and networked and disciplined. So, this is, the path is clear. It's about organization, networking, unity, and discipline. It's about looking beyond the personalities of the candidates and looking about what judges are they going to appoint? Who are they going to appoint to run foreign policy? Who are they going to run and appoint to run the different agencies? How do they stand on some of these issues like human rights and equality or the environment or things like that? And looking beyond the sort of peccadilloes of the leading candidates. It's the religious right is really good at doing that. And then the unity is really key, not just holding yourself accountable to vote, but also holding others accountable to vote and investing in infrastructure where possible, that sort of data, media, and messaging that the right has invested in decades. And I don't think, I think the rise of the religious nationalism is a cause for concern, but it's not a cause for losing hope at all. I'm seeing much more activism and awareness today than I saw 4 or 5 years ago. I think people have sort of woken up a bit. Religious nationalists are using all those tools of democracy to dismantle democracy, and those same tools can be used by all of us to restore it.
Catherine Stewart, book is The Power Worshippers Inside the Dangerous Rise of Religious Nationalism. We will put a link to that on majority.fm. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program. Just a reminder, you can support this program by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you get extra content every day and you help this show stay afloat and thrive. So become a member today if you have the ability to do so. Much appreciated. Also, sign up for the AM Quickie. We're hoping to sell some more advertising against it by this time. We have the numbers, but advertising is not exactly as flowing as we had hoped. But by all means, check it out. People are enjoying it every morning. It's available 6 or 7 minutes. Gives you the top headlines of the day. And you can hear my morning voice half the time. The other half of the time, you can hear Lucy Steiner's voice, which sounds good all the time. And don't forget, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. I am going through a significant amount of the coffee over the course of the day and the show. Fortunately, I got a 5-pound bag of the Majority Report blend, justcoffee.coop. Also, tomorrow night, TMBS. Check out The Michael Brooks Show, patreon.com/The Michael Brooks Show, patreon.com/TMBS, youtube.com/The Michael Brooks Show. Also, Noma Key Const. You can check out Noma Key's show at patreon.com/The Noma Key Show. And also youtube.com, Noma Key Const. I saw a cartoon about the way I pronounced that the other day. So, but I think I nailed it, I think, right now. Oh, and I just saw a video of hers. Darn it. You know, I wanted to pull it. We'll play it tomorrow, but she's doing some great, sort of editorial videos on, just sort of like the really tangible parts of where, of what constitutes, institutional corruption in the context of the Democratic Party. I mean, a lot of times we're just talking about, like, you know, these are just people who are just using these opportunities as a way of making cash and retaining power. And in this instance, the networks of these people are much smaller and very dislodgeable. Very important information. Go check those out. Don't forget the Antifada, patreon.com/The Antifada. New episodes coming out this week. Matt, what's happening on Literary Hangover?
Tonight, I'm going to Twitch stream Doom Eternal and maybe A Plague's Tale, Innocence. So go to patreon.com/literary hangover. I'm going to post it for everybody, but that's where I'm going to post the link. So tonight it is. Check it out, folks. patreon.com/literary hangover.
Going to take a quick break, come back with some phone calls, and you can IM the show via the app at majorityapp.com. Be right back.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh.
Grandpa.
I had
my first post-coital scene with a woman.
I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
You think I might be a Nazi?
Agree.
No.